PA Books is a production of PCN, a nonprofit television network. Listeners like you make our programming possible. To learn more about PCN's mission and to support PCN with a donation, visit PCNTV.com. This link and others can be found in our show notes. We appreciate your support.
Welcome to the PA Books Podcast. I'm Phil Beckman. PA Books features interviews with the authors of Pennsylvania history, culture, and people. In this episode, we speak with Bill Double about his book, Charles E. Hyers and the Drink That Wowed a Nation.
This week on PA Books, Bill Double, author of Charles E. Hyers and the Drink That Wowed a Nation.
Bill Double is the author of Charles E. Hyers and the Drink That Wowed a Nation. Bill, when did Charles Hyers first taste the thing that would become root beer?
Oh, probably, he apprenticed for 4 years, then he came to Philadelphia, then he got married. He was around 21 in that range.
And he and his wife were on vacation somewhere and somebody made something
right.
for him.
Right.
What was it that he tasted?
They went to a farm. We're not sure why they were there. Some people say it was a honeymoon, but I can't find any evidence of that. And anyway, she served them a drink, a beverage. She was known as a concoctor at the time. A lot of farm wives would prepare different foods, particularly drinks, for their guests and their family. And Hyers was particularly taken with this drink, and he thought he could commercialize it. And that's in the era when pharmacists were doing that quite often. They would sell drinks over, they would have rude soda fountains in their pharmacies. So he took it home and experimented a little with it for a year or so. And then he introduced it at the centennial celebration in Philadelphia.
Now he was a pharmacist, but this was a time before modern professionalization and standards would come into play, or it was happening while he was pursuing his career.
Yeah.
But
that's right.
He would have been somebody who, when he tasted something, he would have been able to start thinking his way through ingredients and how all the different parts played together.
Oh, absolutely. And root beer was not exactly a new thing, although a lot of people think he invented root beer, but he really didn't. It was a drink that came in from with colonists from the old country. It was a very low alcohol brew, and it was actually a near beer, and George Washington even served a version of that to his troops, and he left a recipe. But anyway, Hyers experimented with it. He tried all kinds of different variations, but he stuck with the original list of ingredients, which included sassafras, berries, juniper, dog grass, licorice root, caramel, and sugar, lots of sugar.
Now, he was not originally selling it as a bottled drink. He was selling it as the ingredients, right?
No, yeah, he right. He brought it out as a dry drink, which sold for 25 cents a package, and you could make two quarts of root beer. Maybe that was a gallon of root beer. And he sold it like that in the beginning. And he really stuck with that for a long time. But that kind of took off. Advertising helped him a lot. Advertising was just coming into its own. We were in the second industrial revolution, and people were turning out food products in vast amounts, and they turned to advertising to help them sell it. His main advertising agency was another Philadelphia pioneer, N.W. Ayer, and they worked together over the time, and he actually, how he got into that was he had it at the Centennial, and he was riding to work one day on the cable car, which ran along the streets here, and a distinguished looking gentleman came in and sat down beside him. Happened to be George Childs, who was the publisher of the Philadelphia Public Ledger, and apparently he had tasted Hire's brew at the Centennial, and he said, "Why don't you advertise that?" And Hire's protested that he couldn't advertise it because he didn't have enough money. But Childs made him an offer he couldn't refuse. He said, "You advertise it in the Ledger, and I will tell the bookkeeper not to send you a bill until you ask for it." So presumably the sales could cover the cost of the ad. Harris pondered this for a couple of days, but then he walked down to the Ledger office and he presented his first ad, which was very, very plain and simple.
Now, you mentioned in the book that this was a period of great many innovations, both in technology and in business, and that oftentimes people, entrepreneurs, might be good at innovation, but not necessarily good at the commercial side of it, or vice versa, but that Charles Hires was good at both.
Yeah, he really caught on to advertising. He kind of caught the wave there, and he advertised. Trade cards were just coming into vogue then, and these were color pictures with the commercial message on the back, and he had some famous ones. The fact the cover of the book is a trade card of his called the Hires Kid, but he did all kinds of advertising. He eventually convinced Childs to break the rules. They only advertised within columns up until that time, because to do a display ad, you had to cut the columns, the lead columns on the typing plate. But he convinced Childs to do that, and he just used advertising in every way he could. He had trade cards, he did magazines, he did nationwide newspapers. In fact, his first factory, which happened in 1890, he had the whole second floor, it was on Arch Street, and the whole second floor of the factory was a print shop where he just churned out all kinds of advertising materials.
Now, this was also a time period when the soda fountain was becoming popular, often in pharmacies as well as ice cream parlors.
That's right. That's right.
Talk about that development and what Charles Hires' relationship was with the soda fountain.
He started his drugstore in, I think it was about 1872, and it was on Spruce Street, Philadelphia. He had a rude soda fountain there, and that's where he did experiments on the root beer. But actually, when he sold it, it was sold as a dried package, which you had to prepare using sugar, water, and yeast. The yeast later got him into trouble because that gave it a slight alcoholic content.
So as the soda fountains were developing, usually that's a mix of carbonated water with syrup. Was he starting to sell syrup to some of these businesses?
Oh yeah, that's correct. He did. He had a lot of druggists who came to the Centennial, and they took packages back, and he began to sell them syrup, so they could make it at the soda fountain. But he was a little slow in that regard. he was making so much money from the dry stuff that he was selling, the that he kind of grew complacent. And when Coca-Cola came on 10 years later, and Moxie and Dr. Pepper, they were much more advanced in the soda fountain than Hires was. But he captured that a place in that market, and he did it in a very unique way.
So he would end up creating his own soda fountain. How would that work? What was it? What was the design like?
He saw he was way behind compared with his competitors, and the dry product was still selling pretty well, and he got a lot of resistance from his own staff. But he saw the future, and he took a look at this at what was out there, and he determined that if you could get a device that would mix the syrup and the soda fountain in a measured amount, up until then the soda jerk would put the soda in, and then he would put the syrup in. And a lot of times he would use a lot more syrup than was necessary. But Harris had a keg made. There were a lot of inventions at that time. And he called it the money maker. And it would mix one pull of the handle would mix the a perfect stein of root beer. And this kind of took off.
Now, they would also make the transition to bottling root beer, but they had technical difficulties with sealing the top of the bottle.
That's correct.
So how did they overcome that, and how did that change his business?
He started bottling that in about 1890. And you're right, there were two problems that had to be overcome. One was to get a seal that would work. And the person that adopted that was named Painter. And he invented the crown cork seal, which is what you normally find on the bottles today. Then there was the problem with the bottle, because the uniform glass bottle was a problem. And that was finally solved around 1894. And Harris was a pioneer in using both of these, an early adopter, as they say. And he was selling a fair amount of that, but the soda fountain really came on with a rush. And he was not prepared for that.
We'll be back in a moment with the PA Books Podcast.
Enjoying this podcast? Please support PCN with a donation at pcntv.com. This link and others can be found in our show notes. We appreciate your support.
Were there other root beer competitors that he was dealing with?
Oh, yeah. There were some in Philadelphia. There was Barks that came on, that came out of New Orleans. He had a bunch of competitors, but they were all using advertising at that time. The thing about Harris was that he only used the purest, finest ingredients, and he didn't adulterate his soda with any caffeine or coal tar dyes. He would never do that, and he stubbornly refused to do that, even though he was urged to do it. So he kind of stayed on top of the root beer market with the new dispenser. That became a big success, and he sold a lot of those to drugstores.
Now, he also had an interest in the vanilla bean. Why was he so fascinated by that?
He was a wholesale distributor. He got out of the retail drug business fairly soon. And he became a distributor of wholesale drugs and other flavorings. And he was fascinated by the vanilla bean. He made a trip to Mexico and to see the vanilla growing in its native habitat. And that was quite an adventure. He became quite an authority on vanilla. He gave talks to various chemical societies when he came back. But he, and that's what sustained him when his businesses started to level off, was his wholesale business, which was always very good. The other thing that he had to contend with was the alcohol content of the root beer. A guy in New York tested it, supposedly, and he found that it had a high amount of root beer. Well, Harris pretty much refuted him, but he got somebody, some local chemist to test the beer, and it said he said it was had no more alcohol than half a loaf of beer. But then the WCTU took up the cause, and that was the Women's Christian Temperance Union, and that was another kettle of fish entirely. He couldn't. He had always presented it as a drink for people that didn't want alcoholic beverages, but it turned out it did have an amount. And the WCTU opposed him. They declared a national boycott, and that lasted a couple of years. The way he dealt with that was he kept presenting his scientific proof, and he did this largely in ads.
He also was somebody who was doing a lot of public speaking. How did he become involved with that?
Well, that was just like a sideline of his. He enjoyed it, and he did that. He also did some acting. He had a lot of sidelines. One of his the things was he was described as the tycoon with the soul of a chemist, because he was always fooling around with making different flavorings, and he would sometimes neglect his business for that.
Now, one of the other businesses that he was involved in was the condensed milk business.
Oh, yes.
How did he become involved with that, and how lucrative was that for him?
Well, that turned out to be quite lucrative, although it didn't appear that way at first. He did that to diversify. When after the WCTU boycott, he got the message that a business that depended on a single drink would probably be susceptible to those kind of things. So he started making condensed milk in around 1900. Condensed milk had been invented actually before the Civil War by Gail Borden, who led the way. And back then, condensed milk was quite popular because fresh milk could not be sustained very long before refrigeration, and there was a lot of sicknesses caused by spoiled milk. He went to Malvern he bought an old mill in Malvern to start the condensed milk cannery, and he started that, and that was a great day for Malvern. He said he settled there on that because the fresh milk that was available in Delaware County and also in Lancaster County and Chester County. He had some trouble at first with that too, but what happened with the condensed milk was World War I came along. And Nestle was the big giant over in Europe, and they moved their supply chain started in the United States. They got rid of the European business, and this was a boon for condenseries in the U.S. He ended up owning 22 condenseries, and it was quite lucrative. At the end of the war, there was a big bust because Nestle came back, but Nestle then decided to, they wanted to enter the U.S. market. So they set aside $15 million to buy condenseries in the U.S., and Harris was one of them, and he did quite well on that.
As he got older, did he involve his children in the business?
Oh, yes, yes. He had five children, and they were all professionals. They went to the, you know, they went to Wellesley and to Haverford schools mainly. And his Charles E. Harris Jr. was named president of the company, and that was his youngest son. But he had two other sons that were involved in the business at various times. His daughter was a botanist, and she was quite noted, and she actually started her own company as well.
How did Prohibition affect his businesses?
Prohibition was a big help, as you can imagine. When they stopped selling alcohol, a lot of people turned to soft drinks, and it helped the business a lot. Of course, when Prohibition ended, there was another downturn.
When did Charles Hires die?
He died in 1937. He was quite old. He had lived from 1851 to 1937. And somebody wrote a eulogy for him. If I can read it here, if I can find it.
Sure.
This was written in a trade publication. But anyway, it said, Charles Hires lived a long life. From candle to tungsten, he saw the coming of the telephone, the automobile, the radio. He lived through several depressions, world wars. He saw a country progress from slavery to the New Deal. In his own world, he saw chemistry march ahead triumphantly. He saw advertising become a part of American life. Born in 1851, he not only viewed a great pageant, but was a distinguished personage in it. That was pretty nice.
What happened to Hires Root Beer after he passed away?
Hires Root Beer was sold to Consolidated Foods in 1960. And from there, it went through several other corporate owners. And it ended up with Dr. Pepper, now Dr. Pepper Keurig. And that's where it remains. There are a couple, Dr. Pepper made three kinds of root beer. And Harris was not the first choice. And A&W was the root beer that they featured. There's still a couple brewery. There's a couple manufacturers in the United States, and you can still buy Harris on Amazon. But it's hard to find. You can't find it in the stores around here, actually.
Well, we've been speaking with Bill Double. He is the author of Charles E. Hires and The Drink That Wowed a Nation. Bill, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Listeners like you make PCN programming possible. Full episodes of PA Books as well as other PCN programs, are available to stream with the PCN Select app. To learn more about PCN's mission and to support PCN with a donation, visit PCNTV.com. This link and others can be found in our show notes. We appreciate your support.